Good morning. It's nice to see everyone. And we have babies. Wow. So, Tim couldn't be here today. He's needing to get some deep rest. That's what he's doing. And there are some seats up here if... There's two more seats. It was meant to be for families, but if you're more comfortable back there, someone else could come in here. So today is what? The first day of spring is coming. It's really quick, right? And we have to use our imaginations a little bit. So today we're going to have a celebration of the dawning of the Buddha principle in the world. And families will all take part in that, and that'll be after a little talk on something completely different. So I'd like to start and read you this quote. Actually, it's a blog entry from a new friend of mine named Zenshin Florence Kaplow that I met in Oregon. And so I'm going to suggest that you might want to just close your eyes and take this in, okay? Isn't it strange the way so many things are happening all at the same moment? At this moment, as I write this and you read or hear this, an inconceivable number of events are occurring. Someone is experiencing the greatest happiness, another the greatest grief. There's an avalanche cascading down the mountain slope, and somewhere else a light rain has begun to fall. A small creature is being born, and another is dying. A new star is forming, and somewhere else, another star is winking out, its light and heat fading away into darkness. All at once. The Heart Sutra says, form does not differ from emptiness, and emptiness does not differ from form. Another way of saying this is that I am at the same time both an individual with a history and an experience that is uniquely my own and completely connected. I am affected by an earthquake across the ocean from me, and yet I walked these hills as others suffered and died. We breathe the air that has been in the lungs of a lion, the stomata of a 300-year-old coast live oak, and the nose of the Buddha. But when we breathe, only we can breathe our breath, this one irreplaceable, unrepeatable breath. And on the day I die, there will almost certainly be someone walking these hills I walked yesterday, bending to look at a wild flower, smiling at a friend, breathing in the clean ocean air. We will share that moment, not knowing each other, linked inextricably. So, I'd like to dedicate this, anything we do today, to the merit. It's a tradition that came down from our ancestors, dedicating the merit of our practice. And I'd like to dedicate today's practice to all the people in Japan. Yeah, thank you. Jasper. So, on your program, it says, there's a quote from Katagiri Roshi. And some of you will remember this. He used to say this a lot in the 80s. Settle the self on the self and the flower, and let the flower of your life force bloom. So that's a very poetic way of expressing Dogen Zenji's one of his central teachings, that practice and realization are one. So rather than seeing our practice as a means to an end, I do this because I want to become enlightened. We rest in what is, whatever. Go beyond like and dislike, and then we can express our life force, either like Jasper is, or maybe dancing or playing music or whatever it is we do to do that. So when we do Zazen that way, then, as Dogen, speaking through Shohaku Okumura, would say, Zazen does Zazen. We get out of the way. So there's that. And now for something completely different. The talk I prepared today is an introduction to Keizan Zenji. Keizan was in the fourth generation of Japanese ancestors. And he came after there was Dogen, who was the first Japanese ancestor of Soto Zen. And then there was Koan Eijo, and then there was Tetsu Gikai, and then came Keizan. And Keizan is experiencing a bit of a renaissance in Soto Zen. He's become quite prominent, and yet we don't know who he is, right? How many of you know anything about Keizan? Right. Well, we don't know that much about Dogen either, do we? We study Dogen. Actually, the practice periods that we're doing right now is pretty, we're having quite a bit of fun, which, I mean, how about that? Shoto, I mean, how about that, Judy? Can you imagine having fun with Dogen? All those years of serious Dogen study, and now we're having fun. But we don't know him very well. And we know Keizan even less. So Keizan is now being called the compassionate mother of Soto Zen. And Dogen is the stern father figure of Soto Zen. So that's the official characterization in Soto Zen. He lived from 1264 to 1325. And he was a man of his time. In other words, medieval times, medieval Japan. And he's an eclectic figure. Unlike Dogen, he grew up very intimately connected to the nature spirits and the mountain deities. And he was surrounded by indigenous practices, religious practices. And so in his person and in his writings, he exemplifies this synthesis of esoteric practices and pure Zen, Shikantaza style Zen. And, you know, some people have criticized him, saying, you know, that he was maybe a little flaky, but he wasn't flaky, not at all. I mean, his Zen was is very solidly in line with Dogen's Zen. So I'd like to tell you first about some of these official versions of him. He's considered to be gentle and compassionate, whereas Dogen is considered to be rigorous, stern, and profound. Soto Zen Net characterizes them as Keizan is more external. He looks outward and boldly spreads the teaching. And Dogen, more internal, deeply exploring the internal self. So Keizan, I'll go into a little bit about his life. I'll try not to make this talk too long. And by the way, can I borrow a watch from someone? No watch people? Oh, okay. This is closer. Thank you. Yes. Oh, there's a clock right there. Yes. Oh, thank you. It was too close to see. So I'll pay attention to time because in about half an hour, we're going to have a performance. We're going to have a little skit. Okay? So, and we'll do that after my talk. I'll leave. Then we'll have the skit. And then after the skit, we'll do announcements. Okay? Just to let you know what to expect. So, and if anybody feels the need with babies to walk around, you can do that out there. So women were really important to Keizan. He was raised by his grandmother, and her name was Miochi, until he was 8 years old. And at 8 years old, he went into a Heiji monastery. And he became a monk under Gikai, Tetsu Gikai. Because his grandmother, Miochi, was probably one of the first women lay disciples of Dogen's, and she was probably a disciple of Dogen's teacher, also one of his teachers, his first teacher, Myozen, whom he went to China with. Anyway, so literally his links with Soto Zen began before he was even born because of his grandmother. Although his father is never mentioned in his writings, his mother features prominently. Her name was Ikon, and she was a devoted believer in Kenon, the female manifestation of Avalokiteshvara. So there's a story. There are many stories. You know, his biography is pretty mythological, and there are some parallels with the story of Buddha, in that the story is that when Ikon was pregnant with Keizan, she traveled to a Kanon temple to pay her respects, and on the way to the temple, she starts going into labor, and there she gives birth in the temple of Kanon, you know, which forever, of course, links Keizan with Kanon, makes Kanon very important to Keizan. So there's that story. He writes in his diaries about having an easy life in his early life, although I can't imagine that going to live at a Heiji monastery could have been too easy. Perhaps he was talking about his time with his grandmother. Grandmothers are usually pretty sweet to their grandchildren. But he says that as a youth, when he got a little older, he had some anger issues. He had some problems with anger and impatience, and that his mother helped him with that. His mother was a nun. He didn't live with her. She was the abbess of a monastery, of a nunnery, I mean, a nunnery. The women weren't abbots of monasteries in 1250 or whenever it was, 1300. But even though she was a little distant, she took a lot of interest in his life, and she gave him advice, and she was always advising him to overcome his temper and deal with his anger, because she knew that he was going to be a great teacher. And she knew that that was a liability. As we know, now we know a lot about emotional intelligence and the importance of having it for success. So we don't know exactly what is Keizan's true experience and what is legend making, but we can identify with needing to get a handle on our anger, right? Our own anger. So even though Keizan revered Dongshan, Liangzhe, and Wang Bo, the Chinese greats, Chinese ancestors, they set a precedent of leaving their mothers on their deathbeds and going to serve their masters. But Kazan was far from that. He was very connected with his mother. He would have, even though he thought what they did was great, he couldn't do it himself. So he was pretty dependent on her, and he credits her with helping him so much in life. So when she died, she left him as his inheritance, her prized statue of Kanon. So another woman who's important in his life is Mofuku Sonin. Mofuku Sonin is in the list of women ancestors that some of you have seen. And she early on was a very generous benefactor to Kazan and his temples. He started a lot of temples, and he declared her the reincarnation of his grandmother. So she was really important, and she played an advisory role. She lived until past the age of 80, and he did transmit his Dharma robe to her. Recently, Mofuku Sonin's Okaze has been found, and her gravesite was found near where Yokoji is. In 1322, he put her in charge of a nunnery. Oh, of course, she's already died. Now I'm backing up. So, according to Bernard Faure, a biographer of Kazan, Kazan put into practice the theory of equality that Dogen espoused, but that Dogen didn't quite manage to flesh out. His other two prominent women disciples, who in some records are called actual Dharma heirs, are A.Q. and N.Kan. And Kazan translated the Buddhist precepts from Chinese to Japanese for A.Q. and also conferred on her the ability to ordain others. So he was pretty forward thinking, and this seems pretty remarkable for medieval Japan. William Botiford, we met William Botiford, Rosemary and I, at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference, and he gave several talks on Kazan. Shohaku gave a talk. Some representatives, who I can't remember their names, from Soto Shu gave some talks. And Botiford knows a lot about Kazan and Dogen and has translated their works. And according to Botiford, women did not, in medieval Japan, their names were never mentioned in any public record. The only women whose names that you run across are the women who've become nuns, who entered the Buddhist order. Another important element of Kazan that makes him stand out is the role of dreams in Kazan's life. Kazan had a lot of dreams, prophetic dreams, and he followed his dreams. You know, his dreams showed him where to site the monasteries that he opened. And he claims to have had an enlightenment experience under the auspices of Maitreya, Shakyamuni, and one other Buddha I'm not remember, but three of the big the big guys. And I think it was part of medieval culture. He justifies his place religiously through prophecy and through his dreams. And he carries out his dreams. He also met Kanon in his dreams quite a bit. So his teachers, as I said, he worked directly under four of Dogen's main disciples, Kōan Eijō, Jakuin, Gien, and Gikai. After that he went on a pilgrimage for 2 years where he met and studied with two Rinzai teachers who had also studied the Shingon tradition of esoteric ritual. His own teacher, Gikai, was one of Dogen's first disciples along with Kōan Eijō. And an interesting story about Kōan and Gikai is that they were Dogen's first disciples, but they came to him from another teacher named Nonin. And Nonin was Rinzai. And Nonin had not gone to China. to receive the true Dharma. And Nonan had also become enlightened on his own. He had no teacher, you know. So there was a lot of criticism of that style at the time. Dogen was very critical of that. And Kazan was a bit critical of that, but you know, Dogen didn't like Rinzai and criticized Rinzai, but his two, in his own sangha, were Rinzai influences. Because Koan Ajo, when he entered Dogen's sangha, gave up his past associations and completely took on Dogen's way, but Tetsu Gikai was more ambivalent and didn't. So it's interesting when you really look into these traditions, the kinds of things that you find out. And you know, I won't go into all the fighting, all the fighting. But we all know from studying any religion that there's quite a bit of it, and it's usually around issues of power and influence. After a great teacher dies, as in the case of Dogen, you know. There's conflict. After Kazan died, there was conflict. So Kazan is best known for starting Sojiji Monastery, and Sojiji and Eheiji are the two big monasteries in Japan. So Eheiji has more of the religious authority for Soto Zen. Sojiji has many more temples. Many more temples are associated with Sojiji. So he's credited with starting Sojiji, but it was actually his disciples who did that. What he did is start a monastery called Yokoji. And he set up Yokoji to be the institutional center for Soto Zen. But that never happened because his disciples pretty much used his methods to build up Sojiji. And that became the new head temple in Japan. And then there was a lot of fighting in the 1500s and the 1600s. And finally in the 1800s, there was an official truce that recognized both teachers as being important patriarchs, equally important, and both temples being equally important. And he also was credited with starting the system of rotating abbotship that is found in Zen temples now everywhere. Kazan did that. He set that up at Yokoji. So he openly described in his writings his reliance on inspired dreams and astrology, on devotion to his mother and grandmother, and to the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. So he's really different than Dogen. His major writings, and we're going to study Dogen in practice, I mean Kazan, in our morning study groups in the spring. And we'll probably be using this book, Transmission of the Light, or Denko Roku. It's likely we'll use this transition by Thomas Clary. There are two others out that I know of, one by G.U. Kennett and one by Francis Cook. We used this in our practice period at Hokkyoji this winter. And so, you know, as part of our practice, we were doing a lot of Zazen and we were kind of divining this book together as a group practice, trying to figure out what was being said in this book. So this is one of his major works. He also wrote Zazen Yojinki, How to Practice Zazen, which really echoes Fukan Zazengi, but goes further and gets very specific. And it's good. It's interesting. I have a copy of that. He also wrote the Kazan Shingi, which is the procedures for monastic life. This is really his unique contribution, the Denko Roku. And what it is it's called a hagiography. It's like the biographies of the saints. And there's one Shakyamuni Buddha in here and 52 ancestors. So this is considered the Soto Zen lamp record. There are about four or five other lamp records that exist that were written in China. And they have a slightly different structure. This is structured a little bit like the Blue Cliff record, in that these are centered around koans, encounters between master and disciple. So it's a four-part structure. There's a koan, and then there's some details that give you some background, and then there's a commentary, which is really Keizan speaking to us. He's speaking to his monks. These were taken from talks at his monastery, his very remote monastery. But the commentaries really come alive. They really come alive. And at the end, there's a verse. And it's called an appended verse. Most of the lamp records have they have a different type of verse. These appended verses further comment on the koan case itself. So I'd like to share this with you. Share one of these, okay? Not all of it, I promise. I won't read it all. So it starts with Shakyamuni, and then it goes all the way to, I believe, Koan Ajo. So I'm going to read from Kashapa. When the Buddha raised a flower and blinked his eyes, Kashapa broke out in a smile. The Buddha said, "I have the treasury of the eye of truth, the ineffable mind of Nirvana. These I entrust to Kashapa." Kashapa was born in a Brahmin family. In Sanskrit, Kashapa means drinker of light. Sometimes he's been called light drinker, but that's confusing. Drinker of light is a little more kind of... When he was born, a golden light filled the room, then went into his mouth. Hence he was called Kashapa, drinker of light. His complexion was golden, and he had 30 of the 32 major marks of greatness. Kashapa met the Buddha at a shrine known as the Shrine of Many Children. The Buddha said, "Welcome, mendicant." Kashapa, having already shaved his head and put on a patchwork vestment, then the Buddha entrusted him with the treasury of the Eye of Truth. Kashapa practiced austerities and never wasted any time. Only seeing the ugly emaciation of his body and the wretchedness of his clothing, everyone doubted Kashapa. Because of this, every time the Buddha was going to give a talk in some place or the other, he shared his seat with Kashapa, who thenceforth was the senior member of the community. Kashapa was not only the senior member of Shakyamuni Buddha's community, he was the intrepid leader of the communities of all the Buddhas of the past. You should know that he was an ancient Buddha. Do not just class him with the other disciples of Buddha. Before an assembly of 80,000 on Spiritual Mountain, the Buddha raised a flower and blinked his eyes. No one knew his meaning. All remained silent. Then Kashapa alone broke into a smile. The Buddha said, "I have the treasury of the Eye of Truth, the ineffable mind of Nirvana, and the formless teaching of complete illumination. I entrust it all to Kashapa." There's a lot of repetition in these stories. Furthermore, this story, such as it is not a record of the assembly. These words were spoken in entrustment of the bequest at the Shrine of Many Children. The records saying that it took place on Spiritual Mountain are wrong. When the teaching of enlightenment was bequeathed, there was this kind of ceremony. Therefore, if he were not a master bearing the seal of the enlightened mind, Kashapa would not have known the time of that raising of the flower, and he would not have understood that raising of the flower. Investigate carefully, see thoroughly, know that Kashapa is Kashapa, understand Shakyamuni Buddha as Shakyamuni Buddha, and simply transmit the way of complete realization in depth. Leaving aside the raising of the flower for the moment, everyone should clearly understand the blinking of the eyes. You raise your eyebrows and blink your eyes in the ordinary course of things, and Buddha blinked his eyes when he raised the flower. These are not separate at all. Your talking and smiling, and Kashapa's breaking into a smile, are not different at all. Once you come to know the inner self, you'll find that Kashapa can wriggle his toes in your shoes. Do you not realize that where Shakyamuni Buddha raised his eyebrows and blinked his eyes, Shakyamuni immediately died away, and that where Kashapa broke into a smile, Kashapa immediately became enlightened? Is this not then one's own? If you study the way sincerely and investigate it through in every detail, not only is Kashapa not extinct, but Shakyamuni too is eternal. Therefore, since before you were born, it's been pointed out directly and communicated simply, extending over all time, met with everywhere. Therefore, you should not look to 2,000 years in the past. If you just work on the way with alacrity today, Kashapa will be able to appear in the world today without going into Kukutapada Mountain. Old Shakyamuni Buddha is with you all the time. Whatever you're doing, he's conversing and exchanging greetings with you. Never apart from you for a moment. If you never see him, you'll be remiss, and even the hands of 1,000 Buddhas will not reach you. I have some humble words to point out this principle. Know that in the remote recesses of the misty valley, there is another sacred pine that passes the winter cold. So, there's a little taste for you of what it will be like to to study Kazon. And I hope kind of an overview that was clear and not too boring about his life and who he was in our tradition. One of our ancestors. So I'd like to just end with a poem, if I may, and then we'll have a play. The Human Route. Coming empty-handed, going empty-handed, that is human. When you are born, where do you come from? When you die, where do you go? Life is like a floating cloud which appears. Death is like a floating cloud which disappears. The floating cloud itself originally does not exist. Life and death, coming and going, are also like this. But there is one thing which always remains clear. It is pure and clear, not depending on life and death. What is that one pure and clear thing? What is it? So this was a bit of an everything all mixed together talk. But I'm following in the footsteps of my ancestor Kazon. So does anyone want to say anything before we move? Matt? It's anonymous. I asked my friend the same thing. Who wrote the poem? I don't know. We found it. Some of the best poems are anonymous. Written by anonymous.